Okay, I'm just waiting for the clock to tick up to 9:30. Okay, so what I want to do today is not even as ambitious I put on the agenda. What I want to talk about mostly today is subspaces attached to a basis. I talked about that on Wednesday, but I didn't really give you a full example. So the main purpose, which may take up 15, 20 minutes of today's lecture, is to remind you what subspaces we can attach to a matrix and how we find their bases. One thing to say before I even start is, remember matrices are just arrangements of numbers. So attaching a subspace to a matrix, underlying that problem is the problem of how do you compute things in general. And typically what we've done in this course, whether we're solving linear equations or whether we're trying to figure out if a set of vectors are linearly independent or not, we translate problems into a matrix setting where we can actually do calculations. So that's really the point here as well. And so these subspaces, the row space, the column space, the null space of a matrix, they're not going to make a whole lot of sense to you yet because I haven't given you the situations where you need to find a subspace. And then once you figure out what you need, typically introducing a matrix is your first step in towards calculating it. Okay, so let me start by reviewing the subspaces that one can attach to a matrix. They're pretty simple to construct. So if you have a matrix with n rows and n columns, or an n by m matrix, suppose we're given one, and let me indicate by double primes, I've taken this matrix and I've row reduced it all the way to its reduced row echelon form, such as I might if I was trying to solve a linear system involving A. But it turns out that this a row echelon form of A, and even better, the reduced row echelon form of A, will give us explicit construction of the bases for the subspaces attached to this matrix. So for example, you can take the rows of the matrix, take those numbers in each row, and think of them as ordered lists of numbers. So each, since we have n columns, we'll have m numbers in each row. And so each row vector is going to be an m-dimensional vector. When I take the set of all possible linear combinations of these row vectors, I generate a subspace of the space in which those vectors live. That's called the row space of a matrix. And what we found last time is that we can find a basis for this subspace by looking at the a row echelon form or the reduced row echelon form and just grabbing the non-zero row vectors of that matrix in row echelon form. Then you have a basis for the row space of your matrix. Similarly, we can calculate a basis for the column space of a matrix, the span of all the column vectors of the matrix. We find a basis for that by, again, looking at a row echelon form of the original matrix, figuring out where the pivots live, and then going back to the original matrix and grabbing those columns. So the way you find a basis for the column space is you still row reduce your matrix to row echelon form. You see where the pivots are living in that row echelon form. You go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding columns. And then finally, the third subspace one attaches to a matrix. Well, once you have a matrix, you have effectively a coefficient matrix from which you can make a system of homogeneous linear equations. The solution set of the set of linear equations that corresponds to your matrix, that's called the null space of the matrix. And finding a basis for this subspace of Rm, each vector here is a vector in Rm, so the subspace is a subset of Rm. The way we find a basis for this is we simply solve the linear system, express our solution as a hyperplane, and then grab the constant vectors that are being multiplied by your free variables. All right, so that's a verbal description of what we're going to do. Let's do an explicit example where I demonstrate on a particular matrix exactly how we find bases for these three subspaces. But actually, even before that, let me give you a little bit more nomenclature. Every subspace has a basis, and every basis for a subspace has the same number of vectors. We use the number of vectors in any basis. That's what we'll learn to call the dimension of a subspace. And it makes sense of all your usual notions of bases, all your usual notions of dimension. It's the number of independent directions that are actually going to live in the space. Just like we know that physical space is three-dimensional because we have three independent directions that will, from that, we can reach any point. Well, those independent directions are effectively the directions prescribed by basis vectors. Okay, so in particular, for those row spaces or for those subspaces attached to a matrix, we can get the dimension of those guys. It's going to be the number of basis vectors. Now, for the row space, what you do is you row reduce A to row echelon form, and you grab the non-zero rows. Well, every non-zero row is going to have a pivot, the first non-zero entry in that row. And so to count the number of basis vectors, you just calculate a row echelon form of your matrix, and you count the number of pivots in that row echelon form. Each pivot is going to correspond to a non-zero row, which is going to correspond to a basis vector for this subspace. Similarly, the column space, its basis vectors are determined also by the row echelon form of A, but indirectly. What we do here is we row reduce A to a row echelon form, figure out where the pivots live, go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding columns. But the number of columns you actually grab from here is going to be determined by the number of pivots you have in your row echelon form. And so the dimension of the column space is again going to equal the number of pivots of the row echelon form. What I want you to note here is on the preceding slide, if I started off with an n by n matrix, then each row would have n vectors, so that would be a subspace Rm. Meanwhile, sorry, the row space we have the row space of your, if A is as n rows and n columns, then the row space of A is going to be a subspace of Rm, and the column space of A is going to be a subspace of Rn, because in the columns you have an entry for each row. And then we might as well put up here as well the null space of A. Well, in order for this multiplication A time, for this equation to be defined, this vector of variables has to be, well, multiplying an m by m matrix, it's going to be a column vector, it's going to have to be an m by one column vector for that matrix multiplication to be defined. And then what gets out, what's going to be on the right hand side, is an n by one zero vector. But so where these variables actually live, they live in an m-dimensional space. So that's why the null space is a subspace of Rm. And so I notice that while these two guys are basic subspaces of the same vector space, the column space is different. And in fact, the fact that these guys live in different vector spaces, that's what makes it a little bit surprising that the dimension of the row space of a matrix is always equal to the dimension of the column space. So even though the row vectors and column vectors live in different spaces, the space they generate is actually the same dimension. All right, and so there's some more nomenclature on this slide. Just names for the dimension of the row space, the column space, and the null space of the matrix. the common dimension of the row space and the column space, we call that the rank of the matrix. And then the dimension of the null space, the dimension of the solution set of AX is equal to zero, that's called the nullity of a matrix. And what one simple identity that comes out basically just from these definitions, or actually more precisely from the way we compute them, is that the number of columns of the matrix is always equal to the rank and the nullity. Because what the rank is, well, to figure out what it is, you just count the number of pivots of any row echelon form. Same for the column. So if the row echelon form of my matrix is going to determine, I just count the pivots. But the nullity of a matrix, the dimension of the solution set, remember, as we solve linear systems, the idea is to take this guy and row reduce to a reduced row echelon form. And then we, aside from actually furnishing us with the equations that of the solution, we also get from the row echelon form a partitioning of the variables into free variables and fixed variables. The number of free variables is equal to the number of columns in the row echelon form that do not have pivots. So effectively, this rank, this nullity, is going to equal to the number of columns of the row echelon form of A that don't have pivots, because those are going to correspond directly to the free parameters of the solution. And if you know how many parameters you need to describe the solution set, effectively you know the dimension, at least in a formal way or informal way. But the rank of a matrix, well, that's determined by either the number of number of pivots, and so that'd be the same thing as the number of columns with pivots. And so I basically take the columns of A and I can divide it up into two sets, those that contain pivots, those that don't contain pivots. But the respective numbers have to add up to the number of columns. And so this turns out to be a fundamental identity that if you know the rank of A, you also almost immediately know the dimension of the null space as well, because all you have to do is subtract the rank from the number of columns to get the dimension of that null space. Okay, so that much is just nomenclature that we covered on Wednesday. Principal thing I wanted to do today is do an explicit example. Now let me get this situated a little better. All right. So I'm going to start with a 3x3 matrix, and I'm going to assume that I've already done the brute force calculation where I take a matrix and I perform elementary row operations until I get a matrix that's in reduced row echelon form. All right, so I did that by computer, and that's the result. And now from this single row reduction calculation, I'm going to figure out what a basis for the row space of this matrix is, what a basis for its column space is, a basis for its null space, that is the solution set of AX is equal to zero, and I'm going to get the rank of the matrix and its nullity. All right, so each of these is going to be really easy to do. We'll do it basically by inspection of this matrix. So for example, this top line is exactly what I had before. This is my assumption, is that this matrix row reduces to this matrix. All right, so here's a row echelon form of my original matrix. Its non-zero rows provide a basis for the row space of that matrix. So basis for the row space of A, I simply look at the row echelon form, find the non-zero rows, and list them. And that will be my basis. For the column space, here you again work with the row echelon form of the original matrix, but let me lower it a little bit so I can draw on it. Sorry. Here again, you look for the pivots, and The idea for finding a basis for the column space was, well, you don't use these columns. That won't work. But what you do is you figure out where the pivots live in this row echelon form, and you go back to the original matrix, and you grab these two columns. These two columns are going to be a basis for the column space of the original matrix. So in fact, this row echelon form, its column space is actually going to be, in general, different than the column space of the original matrix, because elementary row operations preserve the row space, but they do not preserve the column space. Nevertheless, what we saw last time is that we can use the row reduction of a matrix to its row echelon form. We can still use that calculation to find a basis for the column space. All we have to do is figure out where the pivots live in the row echelon form, and then go grab the corresponding columns in the original matrix. So let me again recenter this. Then for this particular matrix A basis for the column space of that, well, it's going to be, since in the row echelon form the pivots live in the first two columns, I grab the first two columns of A, 1, 2, 1 and 1, 3, 2, and then I'm done. I've got the basis for the column space. But notice, of course, each column that has a pivot also lives in a non-zero row. So that's why we always, the number of basis vectors for the column space always equals the number of basis vectors for the row space, even though they're completely different vectors and subspaces. All right, and then finally we have the null space. And here's where we may have to do a little bit of calculation. It's not that we have to redo the matrix reduction of our matrix A. In fact, that same row reduction of row reducing A to its row echelon form, reduced row echelon form presented here, that same calculation could be used to row reduce the augmented matrix corresponding to the linear system to its row echelon form. It's just all you have to do in this coefficient part, just insert the reduced row echelon form of A, because under your row reduction algorithm, nothing ever happens in this last column. So all the elementary row operations applied to this matrix are going to effectively be the same thing as the row operation applied to A alone, augmented by that zero matrix. All right, but so what we need to do to find a basis for the null space is we need to figure out a basis for the solution set of that system. So the first thing we do is we take the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, and we convert back to equations. And simultaneously, what we do is we look at the form of the reduced row echelon form, and we divide our variables up into free variables and fixed variables. The fixed variables correspond to columns with pivots. That will be x1 and x2. The third column here doesn't contain a pivot, so its corresponding variable is going to be free. So I take the equations coming from the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form. I move the free variables over to the right-hand side, giving me expressions for the fixed variables. And then I substitute in for the fixed variables a general vector that's, if x1 is equal to -5x3 and x2 is equal to 3x1, then these equations are solved, and this guy is going to be a solution of these equations, which is equivalent to the original linear system. Then, seeing how the free variables occur, I extract the free variables, or more precisely, I expand my vector solution in terms of the free variable. And the constant vector that's being multiplied by the free variables, those are going to be your basis vectors. In this case, we have only one free variable, so we have only one constant vector. We have only one basis vector. All right, so although it's kind of slipped off the bottom of the page, a basis for the null space of A, the solution set of the homogeneous linear equation with coefficient matrix A, Its basis is going to be given by this vector, this constant vector, minus 5, 3, and 1. Okay, so that's, yeah.
So the basis vector will be the three variables of a row reduced, of a row echelon form.
So you basically solve the system. So at this point, this is what you did on the first exam, is you had a matrix in reducible echelon form, and you wrote down the solution as a hyperplane. The basis vector is going to be these constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free variables. So you just identify, more or less by inspection. If you know how to interpret this guy, then you've got the basis vector. So the point of this example is for me to show you explicitly how that row reduction to a row echelon form finds you bases for all three subspaces. And once you, the hard part is that, of course, doing the row reduction, doing that carefully so you don't make mistakes. But once you reach the reduced row echelon form, then all the information just pops out from that answer. Okay, so what about the dimensions of these subspaces? The rank, this is the common dimension of the row space or the column space. Put another way, it's the number of basis vectors you have for each of those subspaces. But since we had every pivot in a row echelon form of A is going to give me a non-zero row, I count the number of pivots, I get the dimension of the row space. But also, every pivot of the row echelon form can also give me a basis vector. It's just the rule for getting it is different. You figure out where the pivot lives and you go back to the original matrix. But for each pivot in the row echelon form, I have a corresponding basis vector. And so going back, as soon as I looked at this augmented matrix, I'm counting two columns with pivots. I know that the rank is equal to 2. Here's my two basis vectors for the row space, and the two basis vector for the column space would be figuring out where those two columns came from in the original matrix A. And then the dimension of the null space is equal to the number of free variables, and that's going to equal the number of columns without pivots. I only have one column without pivot in this row echelon form of A, so my null space is going to be one dimensional. And confirming that remark that I made it towards the beginning of the lecture, the rank of a matrix plus the nullity of a matrix, 2 plus 1 is equal to 3, is equal to the total number of columns of the original matrix. Okay, so with that example, I think you can really easily carry out all the problems in homework set 6, which is due on Monday. And while I'm thinking of logistics a little bit, the second exam is going to come up in the near future. Not before spring break. I have one more topic that I want to cover. That will be linear transformations. And we'll actually start a little bit on that today. But I'll probably devote all of next week to linear transformations. And there'll be a homework assignment associated with that as well. Then we have spring break. The following week, I think, is the week of March 21st. That week is a likely spot for the second exam. I'm thinking a logical place to put it would be on Wednesday of that week. That way we can come back from spring break, have a review session on Monday, and then do the exam on Wednesday. I've already had one person request that please do not have an exam on Friday. So I'll, at least initially, I'll try to avoid that slot. And if it turns out that Wednesday works out to be a bad day, then it may be that I actually push forward the exam until Wednesday of the following week. But if I do that, then I'll just start talking about new material when we get back from spring break, and I'll still have a review session, the class meeting directly before the exam. Okay, so good. So now let me proceed to what will be the last topic we cover before the second exam, and that's going to be going to be about linear transformations. So what have we been doing here since the first exam is I've been setting up, we had the vector spaces. And first thing we did after the exam, we talk about subspaces, the subsets of vector spaces that would be relevant to linear algebra. We're thinking of being just being mathematically relevant. Once you have a bunch of sets, the natural thing to consider next would be functions between the two sets. And indeed, this is what we're going to turn to our attention to next, functions that take us between vector spaces. But just like we were very, very specific about what kind of sets would be interesting to linear algebra, so too, when we consider functions between vector spaces, we're going to be very, very choosy about what kind of functions we want to use. And you might guess, since I've been harping about two basic vector operations since the first week of class, that what's going to distinguish between our special functions and more general functions between two vector spaces is their behavior with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. So let's first just talk really briefly about functions. So a function is just a rule for assigning to each member of a given set, X, a certain member of another set, Y. So we generally use this notation, a function from X to Y means that for every element of X, F of X is going to be some element of Y. We call the first set the domain of the function, and the place that you end up after applying a function, we call that the codomain. So here's your picture that you've been seeing ever since high school, I hope, but certainly in calculus, functions take you from one set to another. All right, so what we're going to be interested in linear algebra is a very special family of functions. They're going to be well-behaved with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. Specifically, what we're going to require is, well, we'll be looking at functions that take us from one vector space to another, not necessarily the same vector space. And what we're going to require of them is that, well, they behave well with respect to scalar multiplication in the sense that whether I do a scalar multiplication before I apply the function or after I apply the function, I get the same result. And similarly, with respect to vector addition, if I add two vectors before I apply the function, so I add two vectors, I get a new vector in the domain, then I apply the function. Or if it's a linear transformation, the statement is that whether I add vectors before or after I apply the function between the two vector spaces, I get the same result. And so I'll often say that a linear transformation is a function between vector spaces that preserves scalar multiplication and vector addition. So I'm not exactly sure what this notion of preserving is, but it is clear that somehow the function t here is sort of innocuous with respect to scalar multiplication. I can do the scalar multiplication before or after I apply the function without consequence. Or I can add two vectors before or after I apply the function without consequence. I get the same result. Okay. So the first thing to note about linear transformation, these special functions, is that if they preserve individual acts of vector addition and scalar multiplication, they're also going to preserve the combined action of scalar multiplication and vector addition. So in fact, if you have a linear combination of vectors and you apply a linear transformation to it, well, because these linear transformations are compatible with vector addition, I can delay these summing up these vectors until after I apply the linear transformation. And well, actually, I should do this in two steps. The first thing I should point out is that this is, so forget about this line for the time being. This is the same thing as T times R1 V1 plus T times R2 V2 plus dot, 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 plus T times, I guess the last one is RK VK. All I'm using here is the fact that I can delay these vector sums until after I apply the linear transformation. But then I can, now I have a linear transformation applied to a scalar multiple of a vector. Because it's a linear transformation, I could delay that scalar multiplication until after I apply the function. So I can pull that constant factor through, and I get T of V1 plus, similarly, I can do that for the second term, R2 times T of V2 plus, I guess the last term is going to be RK T of VK, which is what I originally wrote here. So in fact, if you have a linear transformation and it's acting on a linear combination of vectors, well, the result is going to be a linear combination, in fact, the same linear combination as you started off with. It's just that the vectors, b's, have been replaced by t acting on them. Okay, so in some sense, if you have a linear transformation, it also preserves linear combinations in this sense. Okay. Let's see. So I've told you what it is. I haven't given you any examples of what a linear transformation might be. Let's see. In this slide, let me give you an abstract example to sort of tantalize you why these things are so important. So this is an upcoming interpretation of a linear transformation. So let's think of our concrete vector spaces, ordered lists of m numbers. Think of replacing this by a more general vector space, what I want you to think of are functions on the real line that you can differentiate. Now, ordered lists of numbers, at first, you think don't think have anything to do with functions on the real line. But the actual point is that these functions on the real line, they have notions of scalar multiplication and vector addition. If you have a function on the real line, you can create a new function by simply taking the old function and multiplying its values by a common number, lambda. And if you have two functions on the real line, you can create a new function that's the sum of them by demanding that its value is going to be the sum of the values of the individual summing functions. All right, so this set does have a notion of scalar multiplication and vector addition. And what we'll see towards the end of the course, in fact, this is a vector space just as much as this is a vector space, because it is a set with these two fundamental vector space operations. What I want to point out to you is that on this set, there is an easy thing that's easy to see as a linear transformation, the derivative operator. If you take if you act on a function, or even a function that's being multiplied by a number, that's the same thing as lambda times the derivative of x, because differentiation ignores constants. And similarly, I guess I'm writing below the blackboard here, or below the desk here. If I take the derivative of a sum of functions, what I get is the sum of the derivatives. So in the applications that are coming down the road, the analog of a linear transformation on this space could be something like a differential operator, because the derivatives are going to effectively be linear transformations of the space of functions. So I'll come back to this example later, but I just want to show you that there is actually a lot of substance hidden in these definitions. It's just we haven't really gotten to the point where we can see the applications that bring this out. But in fact, my purpose in introducing linear transformations is just so that we can then begin to see how the theory of differential equations, how that is influenced by linear algebra. Okay, so let's go back to a topic at hand. How would I actually write down a linear transformation between two vector spaces? Well, one thing you might suspect, and it's easy to confirm, is that you're not going to have a linear transformation unless the functions, well, I guess I'm going to explain this more carefully. If I have a linear transformation that taking m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors, then a point in this space is getting mapped to a point in an n-dimensional space. So I use a notation there. Yeah, I'll call it. First component is going to depend on where it came from. So x1 to xn. Second component still going to depend on where it came from. So it'll depend on the coordinates x1 to xm. And because you're ending up in an n-dimensional space, you'll have a total of n coordinates in this image, x1 to xm. So when I get down to the nuts and bolts of actually writing down a particular function from an m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space, what that involves is me giving you a list of, for each component here, I need a function of the variables in here. All right, and so what I'm trying to say on this slide is that this will define a linear transformation so long as these functions y1 through yn, functions for the individual components of the vector that you end up on, those functions have to be linear functions in the sense of calculus. You can't have, if you had something like, let's just do a one-dimensional example. We go from R1 to R1. If this were x getting mapped to x squared, it would not be a linear transformation. Because, for example, call this t. So t of lambda times x would be lambda x squared equals lambda squared x squared, but that's not the same thing as lambda times t of x, because this would just be lambda times x squared, and those things are not equal. So one thing that's certainly clear, just when you're looking from a one-dimensional vector space to a one-dimensional vector space, you're not going to be, for these component functions, you're not going to be allowed any nonlinear function, because this property is going to break down. Scalar multiplication is going to break down, and also vector addition is going to break down. So one thing that's going to be necessary for these component functions in order for t to be a linear transformation is that these guys have to be linear functions of the variables. Otherwise, this problem that occurs just mapping R1 to R1 is going to be multiplied when we just have more components to consider. All right, but in addition, they not only have to be linear functions. So functions linear. So function is linear. if it has a form, let's say a function x1 to xm is linear if it has the form f of x equals some constant times the first variable, some constant times the second variable, plus some constant times the last variable, and you could also add in another constant. In fact, the reason why they're called linear functions, take the one-dimensional case, f of x is linear if f of x equals some constant times x plus b. And then the reason why it's called linear, because in calculus, if you graph such a function, it would be a straight line, so hence the word linear, a straight line with slope a and y-intercept b. And all this form does is it generalizes that construction of a linear function for one variable to a construction of a linear function of multiple variables. What I'm saying here, though, is that if I'm going to use a bunch of linear functions to create a linear transformation between two vector spaces, what I need are these component functions to be linear, and I need to get rid of those constant terms as well. I'll show you in the example how the appearance of a constant term in one of these component functions would screw up the the ability to interpret this as a linear transformation. All right, so here's what I mean by a linear function without constant term. For each variable, it's the worst thing that happens to it is being multiplied by some number, and we add it to similar contributions from other variables. But we're not going to include any constant terms because, here's a simple example. I'll try to position a little bit better. If I have a function from a two-dimensional vector space to a three-dimensional vector space, so t is a linear function of s and t, s is a linear function of s and t. This is also a linear function of the variables, but now we have a constant term, and I'll show you how this constant term screws things up. Let's pick an arbitrary point in the domain. When we apply the function t to this point, this is the result, just given by that same formula as I had above. But now when I do a scalar multiplication of a vector and then apply the function, well, now I'm applying it t to new coordinates, rs and rt. But I still have the same rule. So for t, I'll substitute rt. For s, I'll substitute rs. And then here, we have 1 plus rs plus t. I'm just substituting rs for s and rt for t into this formula. On the other hand, if I take this formula and I multiply both sides from the left by the number r, I get this. And now scalar multiplication of this vector by the number r, I move that r through to each component. And here we get an r, not a 1. So what happened here is that the scalar multiple of the of t of v by r is not the same thing as t applied to r times v, because 1 is not going to equal r in general. This would have to be true for all r, not just when r is equal to 1. Okay, so the point of this is that that constant term prevents t from being a linear transformation. But if that had not occurred there, then in fact, I would have gotten the same result. All right, so on this slide, my point was just to show you that, yes, you can make linear transformations out of linear functions, but you have to be careful. You can't include any constant term because that will destroy the property that the function that you're creating would be well behaved with respect to scalar addition. If the value of my function after I do scalar multiplication is not the same as the value of applying directly the function directly to a vector and then doing the scalar multiplication, if these two are not the same same vector, then T is not a linear transformation. Okay, now let me give you an example, and in fact, this is really the basic prototype for a linear transformation. If I actually want to create a linear transformation, without talking about linear functions at all I really need is a matrix by which I can construct a linear transformation. So here's how this is going to work. If you have an n by n matrix, then you can always multiply it from the left by a column vector that has the same number of entries as we have, it has the same number of rows as we have columns of the first factor. Now, this is just matrix multiplication of a column vector by an n by n matrix. But what you can, the way you can interpret this calculation is it's taking an m-dimensional vector and it's producing a vector with n components. And so you are going from an m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, and your results are, you start off with a vector and you get a vector in a different vector space. So let's use this matrix then to define a function between these two vector spaces. Well, such a function is automatically going to be a linear transformation because T of A applied to lambda of X. So I put the subscript here just to emphasize that my particular linear transformation is defined in terms of the input matrix A. But when I do scalar multiplication of a vector and then apply that linear transformation, that's the same thing as multiplying my vector by the matrix. But scalar multiplication commutes with matrix multiplication, so I can pull this factor through the A, and then I have lambda times A of X, or lambda times T of A of X, and I've got the identity I want. This function here preserves scalar multiplication. And it also preserves naturally vector addition, because when I apply the function, which means multiplying by the column vector corresponding to the variable by the matrix A, when I apply the function, I can distribute that matrix multiplication over the sum, and then I get, well, what is effectively T of X1 plus T of X2. And the extreme sides of these two equations verify the essential properties of a linear transformation, that they preserve scalar multiplication and vector addition. Okay, so I guess, yeah.
So if we multiply two matrices, that's a linear transformation.
Well, we'll actually use that. So one thing that's sort of hard to do, you see this a little bit in calculus too, where you start taking compositions of functions. You go from one space to another space to another space, and you try to write the composed function down by substituting results into results. Well, what we're going to find is that when we interpret linear transformations as matrices, that instead of having to compose functions by doing all that substitution, you just multiply the corresponding matrices together. And so, yeah, it's related to that. Okay, so I think what I'll do is, I've just managed to introduce linear transformation. Next week, we'll spend the whole week on dealing with them. Okay, so I'll let you guys go. Do try to do problem set 6 on WebAssign before Monday, and I'll be happy to answer questions on that on Monday as well.
Is that due on Monday?
Pardon?
Is that due on Monday or?
Well, I mean, it's due any time before the end of the semester, really, because I'm leaving the WebAssign, who will still accept the assignment. But if you want to keep up with the course, it should be done on Monday.
Yeah.